this way. I'd ask everybody's patience with us. I will attempt to get this committee excused from the floor, assuming we have enough other members. And we will come back and work here as long as possible, but not beyond 5 p.m., since there are those of us on this committee that need to come back for a hearing here at 6 p.m. We may not be able to get excused. In that case, I will personally come back and adjourn the meeting if we are unable to, but I think we will be. So if you just hang tight, you'll know within a few minutes whether we'll be able to get to come back or not. So we're in recess. Back to order, and I just want everybody here to hear that let's just plow through this. I'm sure that we will have a few members join us. I am informed that we will probably get another call. When we do get another call, I'm just going to adjourn the meeting rather than keep us running back and forth from the floor. So why don't we try and proceed with where we're at?
Mr. Chairman, the next section is the payment of cost section. The new language
number.
This is section 26, and the redrafting put all of the payment of costs for all the various parts of the bill in one place. The new language starts on line 17 through 21, and this provides for the examiners to be paid under RS 151450, which is the Indigent Defense Board, which you've already commented on, but this is the way the bill is drafted.
This is the way the bill is drafted, and we have previously made that the tentative decision, and we're going to draft it so as not to incur any new expenses on the Indigent Defense Board.
The next...
Same with B.
Right. New language 25 through 30, stating that the party subpoenaing witnesses is responsible for payment of the cost. If they're unable to afford payment, the cost shall be provided under, again, Indigent Defense Board. And so this would be the same would apply here.
I've forgotten what we did with that.
You move it back as it goes into the paper.
Where would it go?
Best bet, yes.
Kingsley.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly address this issue. This doesn't, it's not supposed to change any costs. It puts into statute what isn't there now. Right now, under the involuntary commitment statutes, there's no provision for securing how the witnesses are supposed to be secured and who's responsible for paying, and that's because the sections that deal with allowing people to call witnesses haven't been amended since 77, and before the county paid for everything, and now there's a separate state-funded court system. What we have done in these hearings is we have a policy out to our courts that is we pay only under the same conditions we would pay in juvenile and criminal cases, which means we only pay for witnesses called on behalf of indigent persons who are represented by court-appointed counsel, and this just would codify our policy, which would mean if you're one of those 1% that isn't represented by appointed counsel, you would pay as you do now in other proceedings, or if you were a prosecution witness, the county would pay, which is what is consistent with present practice.
But who then pays for an indigent who calls a witness?
An indigent, the state does, and that's what is done now if they're represented by court appointed counsel, which
the state,
they would be.
State, indigent defense, whoever you want to call them.
Right.
The state, it comes out of the state pot.
Right now.
I wish we had more people to hear the answer to this next question. The bill that we just passed earlier on today to the full committee that increases the costs for civil proceedings, would that then be an additional cost to the state?
Not, I believe you passed the amendments which excluded civil commitment hearings.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Let's then proceed. We do not need changes in that part then, in lines 25 through 30. We just need it drafted in proper wording, but, okay.
The next change is lines 35 through 38.
And we've already made the decision.
Yes.
On the AG's office earlier.
Right, so that's done. The next change is 43, is the cost, has the tribe paying the cost of proceedings under 426.180.
The emergency commitment?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that basically all of Section 26. Section 27 has to do with the cost of the hearing. And the only language that's changed there is on line 5, and attorneys appointed.
That probably should be restored if we're not going to put on. Am I correct?
Yes, I think that's right.
If we're going to remove it, we're going to talk about it. We're going to do you appear to have a hearing in papers.
Oh. Oh, okay.
And then take them out. Just like we said that the AG has to.
That's actually has to do with attorneys appointed for recommitment hearings.
We only did that.
426.307. And that's what we left in.
What they need to do is. Yeah, well, the only thing you're.
We're
actually, that's kind of confusing on its own.
And I said that if we have another call, I'm
I think if they leave it out, it's probably best.
I think we're going to. Where are we now? What section? 28. 27, page 21. Are you, Kingsley, you were having a conference there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this is going to sound ironic, and I'll let you make the policy decision. The reason this section was taken out was because, and I was trying to find where it was, I think it's maybe. Well, I'll have to look in just a minute. What it deals with is, this section deals with recertification hearings where a person's already been committed and their 180 days is up and they want a recommitment. Right now, attorneys are appointed for those folks. The way the statute reads is it's paid by the county. A lot of the counties have refused to pay and saying the state really meant to take up all these costs. We have agreed, although we haven't changed our policy, that that's probably the case. It was an oversight because we pay for everything, all the other attorneys in the original commitments. But because it still expressly states that the county pays, then we won't assume the cost unless the statute's changed. So we do not have an objection philosophically to changing it. It adds, we estimated, maybe $50,000 for representation in those cases for a biennium.
But
so.
You've agreed conceptually that cost on recommitment should lie with the state.
Yes, if that's appropriate.
And in order to achieve that objective, the language should be left in. I mean, taken out the way it is.
Taken out, my only concern, I should say it should be rewarded. My only concern was maybe that would take out the DAs and everyone else, too.
Can you work with counsel on
I would
making
be happy
sure
to.
That it accomplishes, assuming that's our objective, Bill, did you have a comment? Yeah. Make sure, Kingsley, that it does accomplish the objective to put that cost on recommitment with the state.
Right.
Where you agree conceptually whether or not you like the financial burden.
Sure.
You ready for section 28?
Mr. Chair, it appears to me that we can go ahead and go on through section 28. Really, all it says is the designee of the director or, and down below, the reasons for the change. There's really no substantive.
The only substance here is that in drafting the trial visit statute bill in the last session, they left off designee of the director, and it's been difficult to implement that statute in some counties because the case managers who are actually doing the work are not immune from liability. So it's a cleanup of a.
What about the language that's removed in lines 20 through 32? Is that placed elsewhere?
Yes, that's moved.
If it is, then we'll move on.
Yeah, it's all moved.
Section
29. Section 29 has to do with revocation of conditional release, outpatient commitment, and trial visit. And this is the part that we were talking about putting some teeth in that.
Of the conditional release revocation.
Right.
What functionally does it do, Dr. Bray, to accomplish those objectives?
Just a moment. I'm trying to find the... The court shall hold, it's on lines, the changes above are relatively minor, and on line 22 through 25, the court shall hold a hearing within 5 judicial days of the date the mentally ill person receives notice under this section. And the court may allow postponement for detention and so forth. So in other words, this is the section where if the person on trial visit violates the conditions of the trial visit or conditional release, that they can be taken back to the court.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's Dr. Bray is correct. What the drafter did was pull all the options short of being directly immediately incarcerated into this section and sets up the procedures for any kind of revocation hearings. So it goes for conditional releases, outpatient commitments, and trial visits. And right now in the law, this is a procedure that exists for trial visits. Outpatient commitments is kind of a variation animal, so hasn't existed before. In conditional release, one of the reasons it wasn't being used was there was no procedure for this. The other thing it does is it specifies that a stated time in which this revocation hearing must be held, which before there wasn't a stated period of time to hold it. And it brings it, I believe, in conformance with what the other
five-day
hearings are for when you're originally being charged.
Comments, committee members. Section 29A. Why is that there? Kingsley, maybe you can quickly tell us.
Mr. Chair, as I understand, by expressly stating the series in which a certain section is to be added, then you can expect to find it there, where otherwise it's the editor's choice if it's a new section and you don't say where it goes.
Thank you. I've never had an explanation of that before. Section 30.
Section 30 defines who is notified of the conditions of placement. And as Kingsley points out, current language in the for a trial visit, but
Mr. Chair, I believe it correlates outpatient commitment and who all gets noticed. It makes it the same as trial visit.
It does.
Is now.
So there's no substantive change there.
Okay, let's move on then to Section 31.
Section 31 is the liability limitations, and this moved all the liability limitations to one section of the bill. Lines 10 through 20 were moved, were brought in from page 6 in our current language. Lines 21 through 23 were brought in our current language. Lines 27 through 29 and 30 through 33 are all current language. The 34 through 37 grants immunity to a guardian. This was the task force. The task force didn't really discuss liability, only extended liability to some people that were not covered. And so there was no attempt on the part of the task force to do anything with liability really at all, except to extend it to the guardians who accept people on conditional release. And examiners.
And that's Section 7?
Yeah.
Examiners?
Wait a minute. It should be. Mm-hmm. Now, the second line, that's not sections.
Were you asking if it's...
Actually, this refers to person receiving treatment during outpatient commitment.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Bray, and on subsection 6, lines 34 through 37, let's take a look at that for a minute.
Okay.
That's new, isn't it?
Yes.
Not moved from anywhere, but that's brand new.
That's right.
Is that the same standard as is presently in the law with the above people?
I don't believe that the one thing in juxtapositioning all these standards is we found that they were different because the different parts of the statute had been enacted at different times and so that the wording was different.
Is that different than the one right up above?
It's not the same as the ones above.
So it's a new standard. How does that affect everything?
I didn't draft this. I don't know. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I think the task force voted on specific positions and who shall be have some immunity and who shouldn't, and then it was left up to the drafter to put it all together. And since we didn't go into what they have now and what they don't, I can't answer that question.
Council.
I could probably go get the drafter. I think I know
Mr. Chairman, if I remember correctly, the difference between sections 1 through 5 and sections 6 and 7 are 1 through 5 pertain to commitment proceedings and 6 and 7 pertain to potential liability after a person has been released on a conditional release to someone else. Am I correct, Dr. Bray, on that?
I'm sorry. I was looking up. I was looking up something.
Council, maybe you repeat that
sure.
For everybody, anyway.
Chairman, yes. Okay, thanks. If I remember correctly, sections 1 through 5 relate to criminal and civil liability as it relates to the commitment proceedings, whereas sections 6 and 7 relate to potential liability where someone is on conditional release. The people who are involved in the decision are the people to whom that person has been released to.
Yes.
Okay.
This 6 and 7, let's go on. What about? We also on standards of liability on section 8.
Yeah, it looks like next year do the same thing. Potential liability after release for outpatient and then for trial visit.
Trial visit, outpatient commitment, and then trial visit. And the outpatient commitment one is new since it was just established in this bill. And trial visit is not new language since it has been
But that relates to what? Patient's expenses while on a trial visit? Sub 8, I mean.
So what caused that to be in there?
This is current language that the a person on trial visit is that the physician or facility granting the trial visit or the superintendent or the is not responsible for paying for the patient's expenses while they're on the trial visit.
It has nothing really to do with liability, though, does it?
No, except
kind of odd that it's in there. But sub 2 of the same section then relates to liability.
Yes. That's liability for the person's misconduct while on trial visit. You enlist the people who are.
Just comment that it's my opinion that committee members that in looking at this where we're adding new limitations of liability in regard to a guardian relative or friend of the mentally ill person or basically anything after line 34 on page 23, my position would be to add in lieu of the standard that's in this statute, the willful and wanton standard, meaning that no person shall recover from these people who have assumed responsibility for the mentally ill person unless that person who has so assumed the responsibility has been willfully and wantonly negligent in following his or her responsibilities that he has taken, that person has taken on, and where we are designating any kind of new law here, it'd be the chair's opinion that we should substitute language rather than have an absolute bar to any kind of liability. I don't know who drafted this language, but if you look at it, for instance, subsection 6, it says any guardian, etc., shall not be liable for any damages whatsoever that are sustained by any person on account of misconduct of the mentally ill person while on conditional release. That would mean somebody who was a guardian, relative, or friend that had some duty while that person was in care would would have no ultimate legal responsibility whatsoever for any wrongs that might be caused by a person that was legally defined as incapacitated. And I would oppose such a limitation the way it's written in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baumann.
Just a point of clarification. I'm going to ask you the question. Maybe counsel could answer it. Does this mean that if you know, they gave someone who was paranoid schizophrenic or whatever illness the keys to their car, and the person went out and exhibiting some sort of sign of the mental illness, drove up on the sidewalk and ran over a couple of pedestrians, that there would be no liability? I mean, is it?
I mean, the way drafted? Your question is the way it's drafted.
The way it's drafted, yeah.
I'm the state representative. I think I'm going to let counsel answer that.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We had testimony at the, I believe, back in February from an attorney here from, I believe, representing the bar. His name escapes me, but I gave to him a factual scenario, something similar to that, where if a person were to leave and say they live next to a school and someone had been committed to their care and they left that individual with a shotgun, and if the mailman or a ball came over the fence from the schoolyard and the kid came out in the backyard and he was paranoid, schizophrenic, and he used a shotgun and shot the kid, that in his opinion there'd be no liability because this is absolute immunity from liability.
Follow-up question?
Sure.
If the standard were changed to willful or wanton misconduct standard, would those two examples, in your opinion, be... create liability for the guardian, relative, or friend of a mentally ill person who assumes responsibility?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it would be a factual question, but I think that under those facts, it would amount to gross negligence, willful, or wanton misconduct to leave a person whom you knew had certain mental problems with a dangerous weapon, be it a car or be it a shotgun.
Mr. Chair, was your suggestion to add willful or wanton or gross and gross negligence?
Willful or wanton negligence in lieu of the standards that are laid out here. Yes, that was my suggestion. Comments? Representative Baumann.
I like the suggestion. I think this is drafted off of I agree with you.
My comment was to where we're adding new exclusions from liability within this bill, that they should be drafted on a willful and wanton basis of negligence, not the absolute manner in which they're drafted. Other committee members?
I like the amendments.
Representative Bellamy, Representative Miller? Comments? Shall we move on? Okay. Am I reading this right, that you don't want to speak at all, one way or the other? Representative Miller?
On this issue?
Yeah, well, you're right, on this particular part of the bill.
I think the observations that you made and the council made were good ones.
Bill? Go on. Chorus of silence. Let's move on to Section 32.
Section 32 is recommitment.
Is there a policy change here, Dr.
No Gray? Policy change, just adds the warning.
I suggest we go on to Section
on
33.
Page 25.
Let's do so.
Section 33 is still a recommitment hearing. Again, this section there is a, it accomplishes many of the same things that we've talked about before, including getting the medical records in, the postponement. So there's really, there's not an issue that we haven't talked about before. And we're just talking about it now in the context of the recommitment hearing.
Medical records at recommitment.
It's one section of that that we pay for the recommitment.
That's been previously spoken to in the same standards as in the original commitment hearing. I'm looking at lines 37 through 40.
This, again, is the use of the medical record for the current period of commitment would be admissible in connection with hearings under this section and considered as evidence. So this would be consistent with a commitment hearing, yes. The recommitment would be the same.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The only thing I was saying, this was the section that I was looking for earlier where I said it would give the responsibility to the state for appointment of counsel in recommitment cases, and that we had no objection to that.
And that's where in Section 33?